We've been dealing with an Old Testament overview, and we've talked about the period of time before the patriarchs. If you deal with the patriarchs, you're dealing with Abraham, and we know that Abraham comes upon the scene around 2165 BC, according to the chronology of the Old Testament. You move from this period of time before the patriarchs to the patriarchs. And then we know what happened in terms of Joseph, and then of course the family of 70 being brought down to Egypt, and they're there in Egypt for 430 years. And then the Exodus takes place under Moses, which happened around 1445 BC. And then we know that they wandered around for 40 years until 1405. And then they moved into the land of Canaan under the leadership of Joshua in 1405. And you have the period of the conquest and the period of the judges. And then you move into the monarchy. You know that the first king was Saul, followed by David, followed by Solomon. But what I'd like to do tonight as we begin is for us to turn to the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 17, where I'd like to read verses 14 through 20 as this writer Moses anticipates this future monarchy that will happen within the nation of Israel. So if you'll notice this in Deuteronomy chapter 17, and I'd like to read verses 14 through 20. He first of all sets forth the qualifications of a future king. And we have this in verses 14 and 15. And it reads like this. Deuteronomy 17, verse 14. When thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God gives thee, and shalt possess it, and shalt dwell therein, and shalt say, I'll set a king over me, like as all the nations that are about me, which happened, as you recall, in 1 Samuel chapter 8. Thou shalt in any wise set him a king over thee, whom the Lord thy God shall choose. One from among your brethren shalt thou set king over thee. Thou mayest not set a stranger over thee, which is not your brother. Now he moves from these qualifications to a series of prohibitions, certain things that the king must not do. This is in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 16 and 17. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord has said unto you, you shall henceforth return no more that way. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, that his heart turn not away. Neither shall he greatly multiply for himself silver and gold. And then you move in the third place to the education of the king, as it is recorded in verses 18 through 20. And it shall be, verse 18, when he sits upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priests and Levites. And it shall be with him, he shall read therein all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to keep all the words of this law and these statutes to do them, that his heart be not lifted up above his brethren, and that he deviate not from the commandment to the right hand or to the left, to the end that he may prolong his days in his kingdom, in his children, in the midst of Israel. So as you read this, you read of the qualifications of the king, prohibitions in terms of the king, and then the education. The king must be educated in terms of the law. He must understand it, and he must do it. But I'd like to come back to the prohibitions. The three prohibitions that are mentioned in verses 16 and 17 that the king was not to do. Now look at the first prohibition. It is in verse 16. But he shall not multiply horses to himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt, to the end that he should multiply horses. For as much as the Lord has said unto you, you shall henceforth return no more that way. Now, when you think of King Solomon, Solomon violated this prohibition. Solomon multiplied horses. And I want you to listen to the words in the historical books. Listen to the statement in 1 Kings chapter 4 and what we read concerning Solomon. Verse 26. And Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 26. Well, listen to the language of 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 26. And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen, whom he bestowed in the cities for chariots and with the king at Jerusalem. And then in verse 28 of chapter 10, we read, and Solomon had horses brought out of Egypt. So what was prohibited in Deuteronomy chapter 17, Solomon violated, and he multiplied horses and received horses from Egypt, as we read it in 1 Kings chapter 4 and 1 Kings chapter 10. Now, the question would be, why? Why would a king want to multiply horses? Listen to the words of Psalm 20 and verse 7. Some trust in chariots and some trust in horses. But we'll remember the name of the Lord our God. Psalm 20, verse 7. Or listen to the words of the prophet Isaiah as the Lord speaking through Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 31, verse 1 says, woe to them who go down to Egypt for help and depend upon horses and trust in chariots because there are many. And in horsemen, because they're very strong. But they look not into the Holy One of Israel, neither seek the Lord. And then in verse 3. Now the Egyptians are men, not God. Their horses flesh, not spirit. When the Lord shall stretch out his hand, both he that helps shall fall, and he that is helped shall fall down, and they all shall fail together. Now, when you read it in Psalm 20 and Isaiah 31, obviously a king would want to multiply horses because he would be fearful. And his trust would be in the horses and in the chariots rather than in the Lord. And so Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 16, prohibits a king to multiply horses because the king was to trust in the Lord, not in his military. Now, there's another prohibition. It is at the end of verse 17 of Deuteronomy 17. And the prohibition is this. Neither shall he greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. So a king was not to multiply silver and gold. But Solomon did that. Solomon violated that prohibition. And we read it very clearly in the historical books. Listen to 1 Kings chapter 10. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 14. Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 14. Listen to the same chapter, verse 27. And the king made silver to be in Jerusalem like stones, and cedars make he to be as the sycamore trees that are in the valley for abundance. So not only do we read of gold in verse 14, we read of silver in verse 27 of 1 Kings chapter 10. Now listen to 2 Chronicles chapter 1, verse 15. And the king Solomon made silver and gold at Jerusalem as plenteous as stones. 2 Chronicles chapter 1 and verse 15. So not only did Solomon violate the prohibition about multiplying horses, he also violated the prohibition about multiplying gold and silver. Now, why would you want gold and silver? Obviously, purchasing power, but obviously also security, trusting in silver and gold. And of course, we read about this all through the scriptures. Listen to the words of Proverbs 23, verse 4. Labor not to be rich. Cease from your own wisdom. Wilt thou set thine eyes upon that which is not? For riches certainly make themselves wings. They fly away like an eagle toward heaven. Proverbs 23, verses 4 and 5. Do you remember what the words of Paul in 1 Timothy chapter 6? Listen to it. Verse 17. Charge them who are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Nor trust in uncertain riches. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 17. And furthermore, if you talk about money like silver and gold, it will never satisfy. Listen to the words of Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 10. He that loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loves abundance with increase. This is vanity. So when you talk about these prohibitions, horses, silver, and gold, a king was not to multiply them. And yet Solomon did. Because he was fearful. He wanted purchasing power. He wanted a standing army. So he trusted in horses. He trusted in chariots. And he multiplied gold and silver. And the text says, it was so abundant, it was as abundant as stones in Jerusalem. Which everybody knows who's ever been in Jerusalem, you have stones everywhere. Now there is a third prohibition. And we have it here in Deuteronomy chapter 17, and it is in verse 17. And it reads like this. Neither shall he multiply wives to himself. Why? That his heart turn not away. A king was not to multiply horses. He was not to multiply gold and silver. He was not to multiply wives. Obviously, a king would be tempted to do it because these were political alliances. So it would safeguard him in the sense of marrying a king's daughter. But furthermore, the text says here, that wife will turn the king's heart away from the Lord. And of course, this is what Solomon did. Solomon multiplied wives, and the wives turned his heart away. Now, I'd like for all of us to turn to 1 Kings chapter 11. And here is where we read it. 1 Kings chapter 11. Notice verse 1. But King Solomon loved many foreign women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, you shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you. For surely they'll turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord, and went not fully after the Lord, as did David his father. Then did Solomon build a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, in the hill that is before Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the children of Ammon. And likewise did he for all of his foreign wives, which burnt incense and sacrificed unto their gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon, because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice. And he commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods, but he kept not that which the Lord commanded. Wherefore the Lord said to Solomon, for as much as this is done by thee, and thou hast not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I'll surely tear the kingdom from thee, and I'll give it to your servant. Notwithstanding, in your days, I will not do it for David thy father's sake, but I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Howbeit, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I'll give one tribe to your son, for David my servant's sake, and for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. Solomon multiplied horses, Solomon multiplied gold and silver, and Solomon multiplied wives. He had 700 wives, princes, 300 concubines. He had 1,000. And we read this, his heart was turned away from the Lord, and we're told it was in his old age. We read it here, as you read it in verse 4, it came to pass when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. Alexander White, the Scottish preacher, said, the secret worm was gnawed all the time in the royal staff upon which Solomon leaned. I mean, God was at work within this man's life. We know it. If you read 1 Kings chapter 11, you come down to verse 14. The Lord stirred up an enemy unto Solomon, Hadad, the Edomite. Then I read verse 23. God stirred him up another adversary, Rezon, the son of Eliada. I read in verse 25. And he was an adversary to Israel all the days of Solomon, beside the mischief that Hadad did. And he was hostile to Israel and reigned over Syria. And then further we read verse 26. And Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephrathite of Zerada, Solomon's servant, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widowed woman, even he lifted up his head against the king. So the Lord stirred up various enemies who caused him major problems. Hadad, Rezon, Jeroboam. And then we come to the end of the chapter, and we simply read of his obituary. Verse 41, chapter 11, 1 Kings, the rest of the acts of Solomon, and all that he did in his wisdom. Are they not written in the book of the acts of Solomon? And the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. 40 years. And Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, his father. Now, when we read this historical account, we do not read anywhere that he ever came to the point of repentance. We never read that Solomon came back to the Lord. We're simply reading here in 1 Kings chapter 11. We read of the enemies that the Lord raised up and caused him major problems the rest of his life, and then he died in 931. That's all we read. But I think the book of Ecclesiastes, written during his sunset years, removes all doubt that this man repented, this man came back to God. And he writes about it, warning the reader about the dangers and the folly of moving away from the Lord and not living for Him. That is the book of Ecclesiastes, written during his sunset years. So with that, I want us to come to the book of Ecclesiastes. We are in this wisdom book, Ecclesiastes. And when we come to the book of Ecclesiastes, as we noted last week, the writer of this wisdom book identifies himself 7 times as what is translated the preacher or translated the teacher. You have it here in chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes, verse 1, verse 2, verse 12. You have it in chapter 7, verse 27. And then when you come to the last chapter, we have it in chapter 12, verse 8, verse 9, and verse 10. Preacher, teacher. Now when you look the word up, as you recall, in Hebrew, the word is Kohelet. And if I think of Kohelet, I think of someone who's involved in the assembly, like the speaker of the assembly. That is the Hebrew word. When I look up the Greek word, and we have the word Ecclesiastes taken from this Greek word, ekklesiastes. If you think of the Greek word, it simply refers to an assembly, and then specifically the member of an assembly, or someone who functions as gathering the assembly together to address the assembly. That's the word. So when we talk about the word here, you're talking about someone who gathers an assembly for the purpose of addressing the assembly about something that is very important. So we would say, we're talking about the leader of an assembly. We're talking about the speaker of the assembly. And he identifies himself in verse 1 of Ecclesiastes 1 as the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And then verse 12, he was king over Israel in Jerusalem. So we're talking about, of course, King Solomon. So he brings the assembly together in his old age, I think, subsequent to what we read in 1 Kings chapter 11, in terms of what is happening there. After that, I think he repents, and we have his manuscript as he addresses the assembly. And he addresses the assembly with this basic theme. And you have it in verse 2. Here it is. Vanity of vanities, says Kohelet. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And what we read here in verse 2 is repeated as we come to the conclusion of the book in chapter 12 and verse 8. Vanity of vanities, says Kohelet. All is vanity. Now think about the way it reads in Hebrew. Hevel havalim, hevel havalim, hekol havel. And then what we read here in verse 2 is repeated exactly in chapter 12, verse 8. Hevel havalim, hekol havel. So when you read it, obviously you would say, this is an extremely important statement as you read it in verse 2. This whole concept of this word vanity, because it's found so many times in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's found everywhere, 38 times. So if I think of the word that is used here translated vanity or meaningless, we're talking about a word that basically talks about breath or vapor. So you're talking about something that's transitory, something that is futile, something that is evanescent, something that is unstable. That's what we think about. So when I read the word, I'm thinking how swiftly earthly things pass away and how little earthly things satisfy the yearnings of the human heart. Even when one possesses certain things, it never really satisfies. So when we think of the word, we think of emptiness, we think of futility, we think of something that just disappears quite quickly, it doesn't leave anything behind, and it can never satisfy. That's what we're thinking about. And when you read the word, since it's doubled, it is a Hebrew superlative. And then when he says in verse 2 and in chapter 12, verse 8, he says all of it. So he's talking about this comprehensively, the totality of everything. The whole of our existence is meaningless. I mean, that is what he's saying. So when I read it in the NIV, it'll say, meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. Now that is what we read. So when you read the statement here, obviously he's underscoring the fact that when you talk about this life, you'd have to say it seems so meaningless. It seems so futile. You get so frustrated by all of the things that happen. And when you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, he'll use phrases that parallel this term. If I'm reading through the book, you remember the phrase, vexation of spirit. Translated also, chasing after the wind. You have it, for example, in verse 14 of this chapter 1. It ends the verse, vexation of spirit. But it's also translated, chasing after the wind. It's just futile. Or you'll have the word, no advantage. No advantage. Or you'll have the phrase, nothing gained. So when you read through the book of Ecclesiastes, he's going to use other terms, he's going to use other phrases that parallel this whole concept of futility. Chase it after the wind, no advantage, nothing gained at all. Those are phrases, those are terms that we read. So when we come to this word vanity, we're talking about something that is unsubstantial. We're talking about something that has no real value or significance at all. That is what we're talking about. We are, as one writer said, empty bubbles floating on a sea of nothingness. Empty bubbles floating on a sea of nothingness. Well, if you just look at life in the here and now, and it's all about us, then we understand that conclusion. So I read the statement here in terms of King Solomon, and he says, on the basis of verse 2, it seems so transitory, it seems so fleeting, it seems so unsubstantial. It soon vanishes, and everything vanishes into nothingness. That's what he says. Now, he moves from this statement in verse 2, which is very important, to this rhetorical question that he asks in verse 3. And the rhetorical question is this. What profit is a man from all of his labor which he takes under the sun? What advantage does a man have of all of his work which he does under the sun? What does a man gain from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? Now that's a rhetorical question. Now let's break it down and let's think about what he's saying. You'd have to say that that word profit or the word advantage or the word gain is a very significant word. When I read through the book of Ecclesiastes, I'll discover that word is found 10 times. 10 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. And what's significant about it is found nowhere else in the Old Testament. It's only found in the book of Ecclesiastes. So we read this word translated profit or advantage or gain. And we have it 10 times in the book of Ecclesiastes, nowhere else. And you know what the basic meaning of the word is? That which is left over. What is left over? So if you think of the word, you think of surplus, you think of advantage, you think of gain in the sense of profit. It is the very opposite of vanity. If vanity is emptiness, this is a word that indicates surplus. It's the very opposite of the word that is used five times in verse 2. So when you think of the word that is used here, let's think of it as that which is left over. Let's think of it in the sense of surplus, gain. So he raises the question, what profit, what surplus, what gain, what advantage has a man? Now, when you read the word man, and you know there are all kinds of Hebrew words for these particular terms, but the word that is used here is the generic Adam, Adam, for man. And if you read this word, you're thinking about man as he was made from the ground. Because when I read it in Genesis 2, Adam was taken from the Adama. The man was taken from the ground. So when you think of this word, and you'd have to say this word is important, Ecclesiastes, Solomon uses it in Ecclesiastes 49 times. So when you talk about this word, man, you think about the fact that man was created from the ground, the earth, and because of sin, man will return to the ground at the time of death. So we're thinking of this word. What profit, what surplus has a man who was taken from the ground, and because of what happened in Genesis 3, he's going to die and he's going to return to the ground. What profit has a man from all of his labor? And when you talk about the word labor, you'd also say this is a very important word. And you know what's interesting about it? He gives us the noun and he gives us the verb. So it reads like this. What profit is a man from all of his labor which he labored? What profit is a man from all of his toil which he toiled? So he gives us the verb, amal, and the noun, amal, in the same verb, in the same verse. The noun and the verb. So what does the noun mean? And you'd have to say this noun is very significant because Solomon will use it 23 times in Ecclesiastes. So if we say labor that he has labored or toil that he has toiled, what does the word emphasize? I am laboring to the point of utter exhaustion. I am toiling to the point of utter exhaustion. This is the word. And yet, even though I'm doing this, I have very little fulfillment in what I'm doing. I'm laboring, I'm toiling, I'm working, I'm exhausted by it, and yet it really doesn't fulfill me. I experience grief and misery, I'm frustrated, I'm weary. This is the word. And he uses the noun, and he uses the verb. So I'm reading the statement, I mean, just look at it, it's a rhetorical question. What profit, what surplus, what gain has a man who's going to die from all of his toil which he has toiled, labor which all he has, and he's labored to the point of exhaustion, and it's just brought misery and frustration, and he's just weary about it all. And then he adds, under the sun. Under the sun. Now this is a critically important phrase, under the sun. It is found in the book of Ecclesiastes 29
times. 29 times. And there is a phrase that parallels it in the book of Ecclesiastes, which is the phrase under heaven. You have it here, for example, in chapter 1. It's in verse 13. See the phrase under heaven? In verse 13 of chapter 1. It's there in chapter 2, verse 3. At the end of the verse, verse 3, chapter 2, under the heaven. And it's used in chapter 3, verse 1, again, under the heaven. So if you talk about under the sun, you're also talking about under the heaven. Now, what does the phrase under the sun or its parallel under heaven mean? Well, it means that we're looking at life from a human perspective. We're looking at life completely horizontally. That's the way we're viewing life. So if we look at life and our existence here from a human perspective, and everything is horizontal. Everything is horizontal. Under the sun, under the heaven. This is all there is. And the question, of course, would be, well, what's the point of it all? What's the significance of it? We're here for a period of time. We don't really know what's going to happen to us, but some dreadful things could happen because we see it all around us. And then eventually we're going to die. So what's the point of it? That's the question. You say, well, you can accumulate all of these things and you can build a great business. And then you can give that business to your son. You'll have something here, and then you can pass it down to your son, who can pass it down to his son. Solomon thought about that. Would you look at what he says in chapter 2, verse 18? Yea, I hated all my labor which I have taken under the sun, because I should leave it to the man that shall be after me. And who knows whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all of my labor, wherein I have labored, and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is vanity. Therefore, I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom and knowledge and equity. You see that? Here's a man who has wisdom. He has practical know-how. He has knowledge. He certainly has information. He has equity. He has the skill, the expertise to do something. Yet to a man that has not labored therein, shall he leave it for his inheritance? This is vanity. It's a great evil. For what has man from all of his labor? And the vexation of his heart wherein he has labored under the sun. For all of his days of sorrows and his travail grief, yea, his heart takes not rest in the night. This is vanity. So I build this business. I'm very successful. I have the know-how. I have the expertise. I have the skill. I actually do it. I pass it down to my son. But how do I know what my son is going to do? He didn't build the business. He doesn't really care about the business. And I don't know if he's going to be a fool or a wise person. So he can destroy everything that I built. So what's the point of it? I was miserable doing it. It was taxing for me to do it. I die. I pass it on. But I have no idea what's going to happen. So what's the point? Listen to the words of the psalmist. Surely every man walks in a vain show. Surely they are disquieted in vain. He heaps up riches. He heaps up riches. And he doesn't know
Who shall gather them? Psalm 39, verse 6. He heaps up riches, doesn't know. Who shall gather them? So what's the point? I build a business. I labor to do all of this. I pass it on. For what? Then I come to chapter 5. Notice what he argues. Verse 10. Chapter 5, verse 10. He that loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. No, he that loves abundance with increase, this is also vanity. When goods increase, they're increased that eat them. What good is there to the owners thereof saving the beholder of them with their eyes? The sleep of a laboring man is sweet. We're in Ecclesiastes 5, verse 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. There is a sore evil. It's a depressing misfortune, which I've seen under the sun. Namely, riches kept for the owners thereof to their hurt. But those riches perish, but evil travail. And he begets a son, and there's nothing in his hand. As he came forth out of his mother's womb, naked shall he return to go as he came. He shall take nothing from his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a sore evil, that at all points as he came, so shall he go. And what profit is he that has labored for the wind? You came into the world with nothing, and you leave the world with nothing. So you do all of this, you labor, and you do all of this, but you're not going to take anything with you. So what's the point? Listen to Job, chapter 1. Verse 21, naked I came out of my mother's womb, and naked I will return there. Naked I came out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. Job 1:21. Listen to the words of Paul, 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7. We brought nothing into this world, and it's certain. We can carry nothing out. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 7. We brought nothing into this world, and it's absolutely certain we're not going to carry anything out. So I build this business. I leave it to my heirs. They destroy it. So what's the point of building the business? I do all of this. There's no satisfaction in terms of what I possess. No satisfaction at all. And then when I die, I'm not going to be able to take any of it with me. So the question, of course, is, what's the purpose? And what's incredibly important to understand is that when we read through this book of Ecclesiastes, it has to be understood that we're doing this in light of death, because no one knows when they're going to die. But death is an absolute certainty. Apart from the coming of Christ, we're going to die. And so you're dealing with all of this in light of this reality. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Would you notice this statement, please? Verse 8. Chapter 8, verse 8. There is no man that has power over the spirit to retain the spirit, neither has he power in the day of death. He doesn't have any power in the day of death. When you talk about death, death is not an accident. Death is a divine appointment. And when we're done, the Lord is going to remove us from here. And we have no idea when it's going to happen. Chapter 9, verse 11. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise,
nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill. The time and chance happens to them all. For man also doesn't know his time, as the fish that are taken in an evil net, as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. And the end is death. It falls suddenly upon them. And you have no idea when it's going to happen. It'll come out of the blue and you die. And it doesn't really matter in terms of money. Accomplishment doesn't matter. I read in the Wall Street Journal today, Poland's richest man, worth $3.9 billion, died. He was 65 years old. He died from surgery complications. 65 years old, gone. $3.9 billion leaves it all behind. Just simply says, Jan Kolsek, country's richest man, dies. And we don't know when it's going to take place. I read the story of a man who was walking in his neighborhood when he came face to face with death. He noticed, he said, an expression of surprise on the creature's horrid countenance. But they passed one another without saying anything. He was so frightened, he went to a wise man to ask what should be done. The wise man told him that death had probably come to take him away the next morning. He was terrified. He asked how he could ever escape. The only solution the two could think of was that the victim should drive all night to a distant city and so elude death. So the man drove to the other city, a terrible journey, never been done in one night before. And when he arrived, he congratulated himself on having eluded death. Just then, death came up to him and tapped him on the shoulder. He said, excuse me, but I've come for you. The terrified man exclaimed, why? I thought I saw you yesterday near my home. Exactly, said death. That was why I looked surprised. For I've been told to meet you today in this city. You never know. No one knows when it's going to happen. Now, it's interesting because I was reading in the recent New Yorker about Tehran. And I was reading about Ayatollah Khomeini, who began the revolution back in 1979. He died in 1989. And it describes his very humble dwellings. But his mausoleum is anything but humble. His mausoleum is unbelievable. When you look at pictures of his mausoleum, I mean, it is absolutely incredible. So he lived in this little humble dwelling, but when he died, they built this huge shrine for him, this huge shrine. But he's gone, and they can visit this little shrine where he's buried. But there's not a whole lot can be done for this fellow. So you think about death. And if everything is just horizontal, if that's all there is, it's just all horizontal. Everything's under the sun, under the heaven. This is all there is. Then we can understand this rhetorical question. What gain, what surface, what profit has a man from all of his labor, which he has labored under the sun? And what's the answer to the rhetorical question? There's no surplus. There's no gain. It's absolutely worthless. What's the point? If this is all there is, then there's no point in it at all. Now there is a psalm, Psalm 49. And I want you to turn back to Psalm 49, and I want you to notice something in terms of Psalm 49. Now this is a wisdom psalm. But I want you to notice what we read in this psalm. Look at verse 6 of Psalm 49. They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a price for him. For the redemption of their soul is costly, and it ceases forever. But he should still live forever and not see corruption. For he sees that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish and leave their wealth to others. The inward thought is that their houses will continue forever and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. Nevertheless, man being in honor abides not. He's like the beast that perishes. Now come, look at verse 16. Be not thou afraid when one is made rich, when the glory of his house is increased. For when he dies, he'll carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. Though while he lived, he blessed his life. And men will praise thee when you do well for yourself. He shall go to the generation of his fathers. They shall never see light. Man that is in honor and understands not, is like the beast that perish. Now the statement in verse 12, he's like a beast that perish, is repeated in verse 20. He's like a beast that perish. If all there is under the sun, under the heaven living, if all there is horizontal living, if we can only look at it from a human perspective, then we're like an animal that dies. And you know what's so sad about it? That's what the vast majority of our culture believes. We're told that the universe came into being by a big bang 13.8 billion years ago. It just happened. 13.8 billion years ago. In terms of the big bang, the universe came into existence. This is taught everywhere. So I read the words in terms of this billionaire who has given $100 million to a team of researchers based at the University of California, Berkeley, to investigate the universe, trying to find out life, trying to find life in the universe. The group plans to rent two of the world's largest telescopes in West Virginia, New South Wales, Australia, trying to find life. So if it just simply happened by chance here, then perhaps it happened somewhere else. So you read Stephen Hawking, who espouses a multiverse theory. Multiverse theory. Meaning ours is not necessarily the only universe there is. There may be an infinite number of universes out there. And Stephen Hawking says he doesn't need God at all to explain it. So you think about what people are saying and what our culture basically says. And you look at Ecclesiastes, and Solomon says, if you are simply under the sun, and that's all you know is life under the sun, then your life is an exercise in futility. It's meaningless. Because everything that the world has to offer, and if you have everything that the world has to offer, then it's never going to satisfy the heart. You're never going to be satisfied.
So Solomon will say, you've got to understand something. There's someone above the sun. In fact, he's the one who created it all. He's the creator. We're on earth, but God's in heaven. And God's the one who did it. You remember Ecclesiastes? How about a verse like this? Ecclesiastes chapter 5 and verse 2. The end of the verse. God is in heaven. Thou upon earth. And then when you come to chapter 12 verse 1, you remember? Remember the Creator. God's in heaven, we're upon earth, he's the one who created it all, and we've got to understand, it's not horizontal, it's vertical. We're not living under the sun, we're living for the one above the sun who created everything. Otherwise, there's no meaning in this life. There's no purpose, significance at all in this life. Now, this is Ecclesiastes. This is what he's going to tell us. And he's going to tell us this in many, many ways. Campbell Morgan said, it's only as a man takes account of that which is over the sun as well as that which is under the sun that things under the sun are seen in their true light. I mean, the only way that we really understand what it's about is to understand God. And to realize that God has made himself known to us by creation, by revelation, certainly by his Son. It's only as a man takes account of that which is over the sun as well as that which is under the sun that things under the sun are seen in their true light. So Ecclesiastes will bring us to reality and force us to really understand, if we're living for the here and now and living for ourselves, what's the point? We've got to understand there's God and there's eternity, and we have to live for him in light of that reality. That's what it's about. Now I'm going to come back to Ecclesiastes. There's so much that we can learn from it, but I want to just talk a little bit more about it. Solomon understood. He tried certain things. But he said, this is what it's about. So that when you come to the conclusion, you remember his words? This is the whole duty of man. Fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man. But God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. That's his conclusion. But we'll come back, Lord willing, and talk about this book. Our gracious Heavenly Father, we thank thee for the book of Ecclesiastes. We thank thee that we can understand what this life is truly all about. We know, Father, horizontally it's meaningless, and yet vertically we know it's extremely meaningful. We understand there is something far more than the here and now. And we thank thee, our Father, that we understand that thou art our Father because of our faith in Jesus Christ. Make all of this real to us, Lord, in our lives, in our minds, even tonight. For I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.